I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Will New York Governor Eliot Spitzer quit? If yesterday's reaction to the news of the fall of the crusading governor was shock, today's is speculation. The Wall Street Journal reports Spitzer may resign as soon as today, a day after law enforcement officials said the crime-busting former prosecutor and state attorney general hired a high-priced call girl, may have transported her across state lines, and used a shell money system to hide funds to pay for her services. In fact, the investigation began when banks noticed frequent money transfers from accounts traced back to Spitzer, who is called Client 9. Spitzer has not been charged with anything and still has not admitted to anything more than unspecified wrongdoing. But what happens next? Amir Afradi reports for The Wall Street Journal. And Amir, it seems like there may be two questions here. First, what political pressure is Spitzer getting to resign?
He's getting a lot of pressure, not only from legislators in Albany, but across the country. And he made it clear to people close to him yesterday that he was likely going to resign as early as today. I think more and more news outlets are beginning to also report the same. So it's looking like that will occur possibly today, and the Lieutenant Governor Patterson is preparing for the transition to become governor.
We want to learn more about Lieutenant Governor David Patterson, but we understand that a spokesperson for the Republican minority leader in New York has issued a statement that the governor has 48 hours to resign or face impeachment. So there might be impeachment charges on the horizon. But what legal charges might Spitzer face? Is it illegal to hire a prostitute?
Well, the short answer is yes, but the federal prosecutors here, prosecutors do not normally prosecute Johns. The issue here for Spitzer is the fact that he was potentially aiding and abetting money laundering. You had a prostitution ring that was hiding behind some front companies, allegedly. Eliot Spitzer knew that. There are still many, many other questions, such as what were public resources used here? You know, he's a governor. He's got a security detail. People were watching him. Was there any public money being spent? That's still very unclear. It's unclear how he made payments. We know about one of the payments that he made because of a complaint that was filed last week against the people who ran the prostitution ring, but there were other bank transfers that he made, and there are other issues. We do know that the investigation was triggered in part by some suspicious activity that a bank noticed with respect to the governor's accounts.
Well, in fact, they pretty much stumbled across him. They were looking at the money movement and maybe thinking that there might have been campaign finance, money laundering, or something. It didn't occur to anyone. It might have been in connection, we understand, with a prostitution ring. And that this moving of money, the crime would be something called structuring, keeping transactions below $10,000 to avoid federal reporting rules?
That could be, yes, that could be part of it. It could also be as simple as conspiracy to to commit money laundering or aiding and abetting money laundering. The structuring issue has to do with basically structuring is sort of a technique in which transactions are kept below $10,000 in order to avoid reporting rules that require that banks, you know, notify federal authorities when a certain amount of money, cash, you know, in accounts is being moved. So if you're moving smaller amounts of cash that would have normally equaled more than $10,000, the reports are generated to see whether there was money laundering, whether the cash movements were intended to hide something.
Right. Well, there were some other damning details today. We mentioned them because of the political ramifications. According to affidavits, the prostitute Spitzer allegedly hired knew that he did not want to use condoms. One can only imagine that one wouldn't want a governor in place who couldn't be behind a campaign for safe sex. I mean, these details have to be damning for him.
Well, there, just the fact that he was engaged allegedly in prostitution and hiring a prostitute is in itself incredibly damning, because he himself is prosecuted as a New York Attorney General for 8 years. He prosecuted people for being involved in prostitution rings. Well, and as governor, he passed legislation to toughen penalties against people who are involved in prostitution rings. So, well, a lot of hypocrisy potentially here.
Well, just briefly, he's Lieutenant Governor in waiting, as we said, David Paterson, potentially the first black, first blind governor in New York. Just briefly, what are New Yorkers saying today about all of this?
What are New Yorkers saying?
Yeah.
About Mr. Paterson?
Well, just the whole shift in their lives suddenly.
Yeah, I mean, this is, I can't emphasize enough how much this has rocked New York City and New York State. Nobody saw this coming, especially from a man who took on corruption that he saw across Wall Street and across many other industries, somebody who had an image of a very tough enforcer, and nobody thought that he himself would have been engaged in this type of wrongdoing. So this comes as an incredible shock.
Amir Afradi, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You might remember when I shared the story of being falsely diagnosed with Addison's disease. Addison's is a disorder that affects the adrenal gland's ability to produce life-saving cortisol, which helps the body respond to trauma and stress. It can be terribly debilitating. President Kennedy had it. It can be fatal, especially if one, for instance, has a car accident and EMTs don't know to administer that cortisol, which is why my doctor had me pin a note to my chest saying I have Addison's disease when I went on car trips. Funny now, not at the time. I did not, thankfully, have Addison's. I had fatigue, in part from staying up too late to read books like Dr. Jerome Groopman's. Groopman is author of How Doctors Think. It's out in paperback this week, and we thought we'd revisit our visit to the doctor's office. Doctor, do you mind if I come down on the floor with you? When I visited Groopman at his office at the Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston, I found him lying on the floor because of back pain. Better than surgery, he said. Groopman is a staff writer for The New Yorker and a professor at Harvard Medical School. His book challenges the thinking that mistakes in medicine are because of technical problems, mixed up blood specimens, for example. He says 80% of errors are made because of the way doctors think. Well, I was still reacting to my false diagnosis and didn't mind at all laying down next to him to find out more.
And also, I'm tired, so anytime I can get on the floor. So what do you think about this? I mean, I went for a month with a sign saying I had Addison's. I mean, that's kind of funny, but not.
Well, sometimes it's very hard to define these kinds of diseases. Physicians have prototypes in their mind of what the typical disease is, but sometimes there are subtle differences, so you need to keep an open mind and keep thinking.
As you say, the question is, what else could it be?
What else could it be? That is the key question. Can this pattern of symptoms, can these blood tests, can these x-rays be rearranged to form a different picture?
You talk in your book about how the way doctors do think, that they reach for anchors.
Well, all of us as physicians are working under time pressure, and we use shortcuts. So we often anchor on the first diagnosis that comes into view. And unfortunately, we tend to not lift the anchor and may discount data that contradicts our assumption.
When you say come into view, it's as soon as the patient comes into view. I mean, the doctor is making the diagnosis from the first hello.
Yes, we look at their skin color. We see how they speak. We're almost doing a neurological examination to see if there's any twitching or muscle discrepancies and so on. But often we interrupt people within 18 seconds and we seize on what might be the first symptom, and that may not be the real clue to the underlying problem.
But how hard is it for doctors who have to often make critical, life and death decisions and have to have supreme, often off-putting self-confidence to do that, to then switch and as you recommend, constantly be thinking, am I wrong?
Well, usually we're right about 80-85% of the time. Now, in an emergency, you know, you need to act quickly and deal with the most urgent life or death situation. And you do need confidence. Now, in terms of other problems, like diagnosis of Addison's disease, where symptoms may be vague and test results may or may not be definitive, you don't want overconfidence. If someone has Addison's disease and it's not recognized, that person, you know, undergoing surgery or in an accident can die from the lack of steroids.
I'm well aware now, Doctor.
Yeah. But on the other hand, even if the doctor's wrong, I've been wrong plenty of times, but my being wrong will spark another doctor to think in a critical way and correct my error.
Let's talk about you being wrong. You state that you made a misdiagnosis, and there's just two words that just jump off the page. They're so chilling. She died.
I was a resident at the time. I was taking care of an older woman who complained of discomfort under her breastbone. I attributed it to heartburn, gave her antacids. She continued to complain, and frankly, I became irritated with her. And I shut my mind off to her persistent complaints. I describe her voice sounding to me like a nail scratching across a chalkboard. And several weeks later, I was urgently paged, and she was in shock. It turned out she had a tear in her aorta, the large vessel that takes blood from the heart. And I missed it, and she died. My friends and, you know, mentors said, oh, well, you know, these are serious problems. She was older. She would probably die anyway, would never survive the surgery. But that was really cold comfort. I have never forgotten it and, frankly, never forgiven myself.
But what would you advise to doctors who, you know, that sends a chill through them and they say, well, in which case, you know, I'm going to just never acknowledge it because it's too painful.
Yeah. We need to learn from our errors. The more we reflect, not only on the fact we made an error, but what I learned from researching is why we make errors. And if we know why we make errors and they're thinking errors, then we can be better doctors and make fewer mistakes. It's because we come to snap judgments or we use these shortcuts where our mind plays tricks on us.
You give so many examples in the book, stories of diagnoses that are missed. One for 15 years, a woman who was thought to be anorexic. It turns out what's the word?
Celiac disease. Yeah. So, you know, she did have psychological problems, but she was...
Well, who wouldn't after 15 years of being thought that you were anorexic and you're not?
Well, that's the thing, is this is a very complicated question in psychiatry, you know, chicken and egg, but suffice it to say that this woman was down to 82 pounds. Her internist, who specialized in eating disorders, kept saying, eat more pasta, eat more bread. She was getting more pain in her belly and diarrhea. And she finally saw a gastroenterologist, Myron Falchuk, on the staff, who did something radically different. He pushed all her records to the side and said, tell me your story from the beginning. He did not receive the diagnosis as set. And he said to himself, what if she's telling me the truth, that she's trying to eat all this pasta and bread and just getting sicker? And it turned out she was allergic to gluten, which is one of the primary components in pasta and bread.
That's Dr. Jerome Groopman, author of How Doctors Think. We'll be back with more from him. Later, we're going to check in on Pakistan, but back in 1 minute, here and now. I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. We're back with more of our conversation with Dr. Jerome Groopman of Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center here in Boston. In his book, How Doctors Think, now out in paperback, Groopman writes about many of the pressures on doctors, from aggressive drug salesmen to more subtle things. I asked him about one revelation in the book, that some doctors just don't like patients with nagging problems and give them poor care.
This comes from research from Deborah Rota at Johns Hopkins and Judy Hall up here in Northeastern, who've studied thousands and thousands of doctor-patient interactions. We like to succeed, and subconsciously, too often, we retreat in the face of potential failure. And so this is something that we need to keep in mind about ourselves, and it's something that, frankly, should be taught in medical school because we are not God. We can't cure everyone.
What do patients do? What do you recommend for people if they suspect that this is what has happened, that they've gotten into a tango with their doctor, that where their doctor just doesn't want to hear from them, but yet they think, the patient, that there's something wrong?
The patient usually blames himself or herself. But the best thing that a patient or a friend or family member can do is to say, you know, I get a sense we're not communicating well, some tension or friction. A good doctor will pause and realize maybe he got irritated, maybe he didn't express something clearly, maybe the patient, you know, was going on a tangent. But opening up the issue helps resolve it. But when I said to fellow doctors, if they were with a physician and they were the patient and they felt the physician was persistently irritable and dismissive, each doctor I talked to said that he or she would find another doctor.
I wonder, though, how practical is it? Because we all know it's harder and harder to get to see a doctor for more than 15 minutes. You write that that's one of the only ways doctors make money lately.
Well, the system is very distorted. Thinking medicine, that pediatricians or internists, primary care docs, where they sit down and talk to you and try to figure out what's going on, is very, very poorly reimbursed. While if you cut, you know, do surgery, it's much more richly reimbursed. So what I say is that if a problem is not resolved, if a symptom is not getting better, then there must be time allotted to think and figure it out. And sometimes that means scheduling another visit in a short period of time if it can't be encompassed in 15 minutes.
By the way, do you think that there are more surgeries than need to be because that is where doctors make money?
I think it's subconscious. There are very few doctors who are prostitutes and are doing things inappropriately. But there's a huge drive. If you look, for example, at spinal fusion surgery, it's very, very small numbers of people who clearly need that operation. But it's about $15,000 to $20,000 for a fusion versus a simple operation on a disc, maybe $5,000, and physical therapy, maybe $1,000. And there's no proof in the vast majority of people that they need such an expensive surgery, but the growth rate in the number of operations is astronomical.
How have doctors responded to your book?
Well, most, in a gratifying way, have embraced it, because I think this has been the sort of unsaid secret, that there is misdiagnosis. We really didn't know why we were making these mistakes, and because I really focus on my own mistakes, the book is being received in a positive way.
You also talk about being a patient. Just some of the experiences you had when you had problems with your hand. At one point, someone called you and said, well, there's spots on your ribs, you have cancer. And you went a night thinking that you had cancer.
Well, this is really very educational for me. One of the surgeons I saw ordered a bone scan, and I was alone at home, and I get a call in the evening, and the surgeon says, well, you know, there's no rush to operate on your hand because the bone scan looks as though there's spots on your ribs that look like metastatic cancer. Now, I'm a cancer specialist. And I'm pretty well put together psychologically, but within seconds of hearing this, my ribs started to hurt. And I spent the whole night tossing and turning, and I had severe pain, and it was clearly psychosomatic. The next morning, I was first in line to get regular x-rays, and it was an artifact. Many of these scans are not read properly. There's about a 20% error rate in radiology. But the mind is very powerful in terms of expressing itself in the body.
Because as soon as you realized that you didn't have cancer, it had been read wrong, suddenly the pain started to dissipate.
Yeah, within the period of a few hours.
But you also came across some, you know, by your description, very arrogant doctors. Now, I'm going to rush to say there are, of course, wonderful doctors and terrible patients. But having said that, you write something that's so chilling that there are doctors who maybe, you know, they have an attitude about you. I remember coming across a doctor treating my mom when she was, you know, very ill, who picked a fight with me because he didn't like public radio. And I remember thinking, oh, my gosh, he's taking care of my mom. And that in fact, that might transfer into less care.
No doubt. Again, all this work done by Deborah Roeder and Judy Hall shows that how the doctor feels about you, particularly if he stereotypes you. And this is very common for middle-aged women who are undergoing menopause. It's also common for elderly people. We make what are called these attribution errors. We have stereotypes in our mind. And sometimes if we have a negative stereotype, like I write in the book about a guy who had a little alcohol on his breath, immediately they thought he was a boozer. But he had liver disease from something unrelated to alcohol, and he wasn't even an alcoholic.
Or the diabetic who'd been found going into a coma, and it was assumed he was an alcoholic.
Right. If you feel you're being stereotyped, like this one woman who was in the middle of menopause, she said, you know, I am high strung. I'm having a tough time in menopause. But I really feel something's different. I feel these explosions in my body. And it turned out she had a tumor that was producing adrenaline that four doctors had missed. There are just a series of very simple questions. What else could it be? Could two things be going on at once? And the other one is there anything, any blood test, physical finding, x-ray result, that seems to contradict what the assumed diagnosis is? And this is all critical if things are not getting better.
Dr. Jerome Groopman of Harvard Medical School and Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, we spoke to him in his office about his book, How Doctors Think, which is out in paperback this week. Well, tomorrow on Here and Now, the suburb, it's a new city. One architect says, let's just start treating it like one. Let's give suburbs an identity. That's tomorrow. Still ahead today, Pakistan, a new round of suicide bombs, even as newly energized political parties move to return the country to democracy. We'll have that after the news, Here and Now. Two suicide bombers detonated themselves minutes apart in Lahore, Pakistan today, killing at least 24 people, wounding hundreds of others. The first bomb targeted the regional headquarters of Pakistan's chief law enforcement agency. It could be heard from miles as it ripped through a seven-story building and damaged scores of nearby homes. The second struck an advertising office in a central residential neighborhood. The attacks came just days after the country's leading political parties joined together to announce a new charter of democracy, which would strengthen the country's judiciary, strengthen the hand of the elected parliament, and increase civilian control over the nation's military, essentially a repudiation of President Pervez Musharraf, a critical U.S. ally. So what happens now? Adil Najam is professor of international relations and director of the Pardee Center at Boston University. Professor Najam, welcome back.
Very good to be here, Jarvin.
And tell us more about what these moves by the political parties mean. For instance, would this move about the judiciary be to restore the judges removed by Musharraf?
We really don't know. And that is really, Pakistan is in a state of confusion. Including on these statements, it is not clear what they mean by restoration. It isn't clear who they intend to restore. What General Musharraf has done to the judiciary is to make it a complete mess. A number of different types of judges have been removed at various points. New ones have been appointed. And what you are in is a constitutional mess about who you reinstate, what happens to the new ones, what happens to the ones who were removed the first round, what happens to the ones who were removed the second round. But I think what's really central here is that the politicians have realized that the judiciary issue is not going to go away.
Well, and remind us, too, how does it work? If these two parties declare this charter of democracy, do they overrule President Musharraf? Do they have the power to do that?
No, they don't. What they do have the power is that in the parliament, they might have enough votes between themselves and their allies to nudge and push General Musharraf to do this. Now, frankly speaking, it's not General Musharraf who would restore them. The parliament would. Mm. And the question is whether they will have enough of a majority in the parliament. Because between the two of them, they might not, because they need two-thirds. And it's really sort of this constitutional mess. Here's the odd thing, Robin. We're nearly a month since the election. The country doesn't know who the next prime minister will be. The country doesn't know what this means for General Musharraf. The country doesn't know what is going to happen to the judiciary, which really is the biggest political question. And most importantly, the country doesn't know where the U.S., the key ally, stands on any of these three issues.
Well, I want to ask you, how do you think Washington would react, for instance, to the idea of the judges that were fired by Musharraf in November being restored? I mean, it would seem to be central to a democracy.
It would, exactly. If you think about the judges' issue, who are they? So this is the most liberal, most educated, generally pro-Western, clearly pro-democracy movement in a major Islamic country. and who is standing between them and restoration? It's essentially General Musharraf and Washington. It's always amazing that Washington isn't more embarrassed by its own stand on the judiciary in Pakistan.
Why do you think that is?
I think Washington is in a stand-by-your-man type of mood with General Musharraf and has convinced itself that its alliance is with General Musharraf rather than with Pakistan. And because General Musharraf doesn't like the judges, Washington is willing, I think wrongly, to keep standing by its man.
Well, given that, and let's also bring in the violence from today, these mm-hmm. two suicide bombs. No group has yet claimed responsibility. But the city's police chief says the law enforcement apparatus is being targeted in this country. By whom? I mean, how do you read this? Because it seems there could be so many candidates who'd want to, you know, come into what might be seen now as a political void.
Well, there is a political void, but I think the primary candidate remains the extremist religious militants. These attacks are really at the stability of Pakistan, and in that sense, they are part of the larger war on terror, if you will. They are directed towards General Musharraf, and in some ways, I would say, also sort of towards his alliance, not in some ways, but clearly in his alliance towards with the United States. And I think they are doing two things. They are sending a message to General Musharraf that he hasn't been and isn't in control of the country, and they are sending a message to the incoming government that, by the way, we are still here and you'll have to deal with us some way.
Well, given that, let's bring in recent reports that the United States was negotiating for a while and thinking of bringing in U.S. forces to work alongside Pakistan forces to seek out al-Qaeda. Some of the presidential candidates have talked about what they would do in Pakistan. Barack Obama saying early on we'd go in and bomb if we thought we found al-Qaeda forces. Hillary Clinton saying, well, no, we'd negotiate with the government. Given all of this, how nervous is Washington about, you know, just how to prosecute the war on terror when the country seems so unstable?
Yeah, I think Washington is more distracted than it is nervous. The current administration, George Bush, is really a lame duck in many ways in international policy, but nowhere more so than in Pakistan. It is not clear where Washington's future policy on Pakistan is going to be. It is not clear where Pakistan's own political direction is going to be. And in some ways, I think Washington has just raised its hand and given up and is taking a wait-and-see attitude, because there isn't any semblance of a policy on Pakistan. Washington should be nervous, but Washington should also, I think, be rather glad that there is actually real democratic forces in Pakistan. And the sad thing is that instead of strengthening and supporting those forces, Washington seems to be sort of keep stumbling along in this relationship with a dictator that it can't seem to get out of.
And just briefly, some of these new political players, not new to Washington, certainly, because they're return players. We have Benazir Bhutto's widower, Azif Zardari, who leads yeah. one party. We have Nawaz Sharif. He was the former prime minister who had been exiled by Pervez Musharraf, now joining forces. How does Washington approach them?
Well, first of all, neither of these two people has actually been elected to the parliament themselves. That's the one interesting thing. So neither of them can themselves become prime minister. And this is largely because there are a number of corruption and other charges and cases against them, so they can't run. I think the implication of their coming together is, and the message to Washington really is, that the whole country is really united in the desire to sort of see an end to this military rule and General Musharraf's rule. So that's the only thing really that unites them. But what is also happening, and this is the dangerous part of it, is that most Pakistanis are quite convinced they don't want General Musharraf to stay. All polls suggest that. Most Pakistanis have voted for these two parties, but rather hesitantly and much more as an anti-Musharraf vote. And the question is that in this vacuum, will the religious extremists fill it in or someone else?
Anil Dajam, Professor of International Relations and Director of the Party Center at Boston University. Professor, it's always nice to talk to you. Thank you very much.
My pleasure.
And you're listening to Here and Now.
environmental groups are suing the Bush administration over its two-month delay in deciding whether to make the polar bear the first animal to be declared a threatened species because of climate change. The groups say the government has enough scientific evidence to list the animal. Andrew Wetzler with the National Resources Defense Council believes the delay may be connected to a government sale of oil and gas drilling rights off the coast of Alaska, including waters that are home to polar bears. Wetzler says granting the polar bear threatened status would bring new habitat protections and more scrutiny of projects that could affect the polar bear population.
And that's why the Inspector General of the Department of the Interior opened an investigation into the delay, because it appears that the Bush administration may be trying to grease the skids for oil and gas development at the expense of the polar bear.
The oil and gas industry opposes the designation, arguing the polar bear's population is healthy and that a decision shouldn't be based on future projections. Valerie Fellows, a spokesperson for the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, says the delay is not politically motivated.
I can say that our decision and the delay of our decision has actually nothing to do with anything else, and it's just taken longer than anticipated.
A U.S. Geological Survey report last year estimated that two-thirds of the polar bear population could be lost by mid-century because of melting Arctic sea ice. Well, meanwhile, at the other end of the planet, scientists are warning that rising temperatures will, for the first time in some 50 million years, enable crabs and other predators to invade Antarctic waters. Here now is Kurt Nickisch reports.
Frozen solid is a term often used to describe the southern pole, but frozen in time might be a better term. Its ice-cold waters are home to a stunning array of life. Sea lilies, giant ribbonworms, and sea spiders, for example, have evolved over millions of years to handle that extreme environment. But now those marvels of evolution face a gathering threat. That's according to researchers who presented their findings at a conference in Boston recently. Sven Tatia is from the University of Southampton in England.
The champions of cold adaptation came at the cost of not being very flexible with higher temperatures. The temperature itself would be the final kiss.
What worries Tatia and other researchers is how greenhouse gases are warming polar waters. Over the last 50 years, surface temperatures off the Antarctic Peninsula are up almost 2 degrees, making it one of the Earth's fastest warming oceans. Now, a couple degrees may not sound like much, but Cheryl Wilga, a scientist at the University of Rhode Island, says it's enough to make it physiologically possible for crabs and sharks to invade Antarctica.
King crabs are currently massing in the deep waters off the coast of Antarctica, where it's slightly warmer, about 4 degrees. And as surface waters continue to warm, they will start moving up into the shallow waters around Antarctica.
When they do, they'll tear into defenseless species that have not seen predators for millions of years. And Wilg is afraid sharks can be introduced to Antarctica by the growing number of ships heading there, which can transport small predators in ballast water. The upshot for the Southern Pole ecosystem will be devastating, says Richard Aronson. He's a marine scientist at the Dauphin Island Sea Lab in Alabama.
There are going to be winners and losers of the Antarctic fauna as these predators invade. Brittle stars are going to be hammered. They're just going to get clobbered by invading predators, but the brachiopods or the lampshells, they'll do fine regardless.
What that means is an entirely new ecosystem with far fewer species. Aronson says the loss of biodiversity would be dramatic.
It's like saying, well, what would you care if we took Michelangelo's David and threw it in the dumpster? I mean, this is about the way we want this planet to look for future generations.
There may also be practical implications to keeping Antarctic sea life intact. The National Cancer Institute is currently studying a chemical produced by a sea squirt found there that could help fight melanoma. For that reason and more, researcher Sven Tatia says Antarctica's wealth of life needs to be preserved.
If we lose biodiversity without knowing what actually is out there, it's not only a threat to ourselves, but the world would be a much duller place, and I would not like to live in such a world.
Scientists say unless far more is done soon to offset global warming, Antarctic sea life, which has thrived for millions of years in harsh, undisturbed conditions, may be under thin ice.
Here now is Kurt Nickisch. Well, coming up, the Chicago 10 and 1, Abby Hoffman in particular, here and now.
Democratic convention is about to begin in a police state.
That's news anchor Walter Cronkite in a clip from the new film Chicago 10. The documentary blends animation and news footage to tell the story of the 1968 Democratic Convention in Chicago. Over 5 days, Americans watched on television as thousands of Vietnam War protesters gathered and warily faced off with Chicago police and National Guardsmen. Then, in increasingly violent interactions, they were beaten by the police, tear-gassed by the National Guard troops, chased by lumbering tanks. It looked more like the Soviet crackdown in Czechoslovakia the week before than America. And it came after the assassinations of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. It was a violent summer. Then, in a circus-like trial, a question was posed. Were the riots in Chicago incited by the activists behind the protests, or were they provoked by hardline Chicago Mayor Richard Daley? The Chicago 10, including Abby Hoffman, were accused of being the provocateurs.
Did you intend to incite,
sir? It's a state-of-mind trial. I mean, we're being tried for our thoughts.
Chicago 10 writer and director Brett Morgan joins us now with more. Welcome.
Thanks, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. First of all, how old are you?
I am 39. I experienced the events of Chicago from the safety of my mother's womb.
Yeah, well, then why? That's the question. Why revisit this? What did it mean to you?
The year 1968 has been so heavily documented and mythologized that in many ways I felt that I was not so much making a film about the events of 68 as much as I was making a film about today and using the iconography and the imagery of 68 to bring this story to a new generation who might not be familiar with it.
Well, you do remind us of some of that history in the film. We see Lyndon Johnson announcing an increase in the draft quotient from 17 to 35,000. We see members of the Chicago 10, the accused, including yippies like Abby Hoffman or more professorial types like David Dellinger of the Mobilization Committee to End the War, meeting before the convention. There's no denying they were planning on doing something in Chicago.
This whole thing kind of started with three guys sitting around an apartment on the Lower East Side on New Year's Eve 1967 smoking a joint saying, we should do something in Chicago. One of the famous lines from the trial from Abby Hoffman is, conspiracy, we can't even agree on lunch. And for the yippies, I think they understood that all they had to do was show up and smile, and Mayor Daley would freak out and call out the National Guard and the Army. People like Daley and Judge Hoffman didn't know how to deal with them, so they would just label them commies and communists.
You're speaking of Judge Julius Hoffman. There were no cameras in the courtroom, so you use animation. Actors like Hank Azaria voicing Abby Hoffman, Nick Nolte is the prosecutor, Thomas Foran. Here's a scene, Black Panther co-founder Bobby Seale, played by Jeffrey Wright. He's trying to represent himself before Judge Julius Hoffman. Let's listen.
I want to request again, demand again, that I be able to cross-examine the witness. You have Benjamin Franklin and George Washington sitting in pictures behind you, and they were slave owners. That's what they were. They owned slaves. And you acted in the same manner by denying me my constitutional right.
Young man, if you...
Look, old man, you're being exposed to the public and to the world that you don't
want to... Have him sit down, Mr. Marshall.
I want to defend myself. I have the right to speak on behalf of my constitutional rights.
I didn't think I would ever live to sit on a bench in a courtroom where George Washington was assailed by a defendant and a judge was criticized for having his portrait on the wall.
Brett, how did you shape this scene? Were these the words, first of all, from the transcript, and then how did you come to the tone?
Well, first of all, that was the late, great Roy Scheider as Judge Hoffman, and all the words are verbatim from the taken directly from the court transcripts. We discovered and found courtroom audio that no one knew was in existence, and it hadn't been heard in 40 years. After unearthing that, we were able to use that as a sort of basis for most of our performances.
Later, Judge Hoffman has Bobby Seale gagged and bound to his chair in the courtroom. Did that happen? Did the defendants throw paper planes or come to court in judges' robes?
It all happened. You had Judge Hoffman, who was just the perfect sort of foil, if you will, for this trial that was basically a who's who of the anti-war movement of the 1960s.
Brett Morgan, Tom Hayden was quoted in the New York Times as saying that this is really kind of an Abby Hoffman film. While you gave all the defendants their due by naming the film Chicago 10, it does focus so much on him.
Is that impossible not to do? He's such a character.
I think I would have a hard time staying awake in the edit room for 3 years if it was the Tom Hayden story. Abby was so charismatic and really, to some extent, is one of the fathers of the modern-day soundbite.
Well, I'm wondering, though, we watched the film aware that Abby Hoffman killed himself in 1989 at the age of 52. Are we seeing here, you know, someone who maybe is already losing his grip because of his inability to get the power structure to react to him?
I think what you're seeing is someone who's completely committed and willing to lay down their life for their beliefs. And what Abby's, I think, contribution to the discussion at the time was, he was able to bring a sense of fun and a sense of theater to what was a very serious and earnest debate about the war in Vietnam.
You know, I was also thinking while I was watching it that maybe we're seeing someone who was never happier. And after the movement, you know, moved on, maybe we were seeing someone who was never happier.
He never had the same stage that he had in Chicago. The trial was such an enormous moment in American history that I don't think any of them would ever be in a situation where they would have the same platform to communicate to the rest of the country.
Well, here's another animated scene with real sound. This is Abby Hoffman placing collect calls to Bob Fass on WBAI Radio in New York City. Let's listen.
Yeah. Call from Mr. Hoffman. Will you accept the charge?
Yes, we'll accept the charge, but would you like to say hello to anybody in New York, operator?
No, sir, thank you.
All right, thank you. Hi, Abby.
Robert.
Hi.
It's a chilly night here.
Yeah?
Yeah, how are you doing, man?
Okay, how was it in court today?
Oh, it's unbelievable. I mean, our trial is a jewel.
Well, the judge, he's 74 years old, he was alive at the first and second Balkan Wars. I think he just missed going on the Titanic. Yeah, I think he's even beyond the generation gap.
Are you sure you're not related to him?
No.
Are you sure? The name.
I brought him a present, though. What? I heard he had tired blood, and I bought him a year's supply of Geritol.
Do you really think he'd take a thing like that kindly, Abby? Giving him Geritol?
Well, he has a bit of a sense of humor.
He might think of it as an attempt to bribe him.
Well,
I think you probably are relatives in some distant way, Abby.
Some distant way,
yeah.
In the great conspiracy, we're all sort of relatives.
Well, in the end, 5 of the 7 defendants were convicted of the incite to riot charges, but all the convictions were eventually overturned on appeal. Abby Hoffman, as we said, committed suicide. Jerry Rubin died after he was hit by a car.
We don't need to do a postscript. It's so not what this movie's about. I was very interested in trying to make a film that would play as a sort of fable for all times. You know, there's a war, there's an opposition to a war, and there's a government trying to silence the opposition.
But I'm wondering, though, you say we don't need a postscript, but you can't help but think of a possible one, which is that their movement died. I mean, we have 2 wars right now in the United States, and it's unimaginable that kind of protest would take place.
I've been screening the film across college campuses all over the country over the last year, and I could tell you that the words of these characters are still resonating with audiences today. You could say that, yes, the war went on for another 7 years, and what did it all come to? What we're simply doing with this film is putting up a mirror to our audience and asking them to ask themselves, what are you willing to do for your cause? We're not saying that you should go out and get your heads bashed in. People have different modes of protest. I think ultimately everyone's got to sort of ask themselves what works best for them.
Brett Morgan wrote and directed the film Chicago 10. For more about the film, you can go to our website, here-now.org. Brett, thanks for speaking with us about it.
Thanks so much.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.